Well, it's nice to see everybody. Hope there was a little bit of sleeping last night. And if there wasn't a whole lot, I'll just bring back my suggestion not to be too sure of your predictions of how the day's gonna go. We'll see. And then there's tonight. Take another run at it. Anyway, I've been thinking about our minds, and so I want to just share a few thoughts, you know, which were kind of a mix, I suppose, of my observations, my limited understanding of Buddhist psychology and cognitive Western psychology, and who knows what, none of which am I an expert in, so take it all with a grain of salt. And really the intention of having a talk and a meditation retreat is mostly just encouragement, you know. Not so much like there's some kind of little nugget of information in here that if I just say it right and you just hear it right, everything will suddenly be better, you know. You're still you. And will remain you for the duration. But luckily you also change, right? So there is some information. We got to use information to talk. But mostly it's about encouragement and maybe a little bit of entertainment. And then we just continue, you know, for the rest of the day. So anyway, a few thoughts about the mind. My main thought is the mind is really pretty amazing. Somehow, all these vast sort of deluges of information coming in through all five senses all the time. And then in Buddhism, they think about the thinking as kind of a sixth sense, the part of the mind that can recognize thoughts. Tons of information coming in there, right? Because there's all these thoughts, as you maybe noticed today, you know? So somehow all this stuff is coming in all the time, and the mind is able to like weave it together into some kind of more or less coherent narrative about who I am and what's happening, what's going on around me, what the world is. So what a prodigious task, you know? You could never figure out how to do that, you know, but somehow your mind just does this automatically. Kind of makes sense somehow of all that's going on. Sometimes, of course, this sense-making breaks down. And we get all tangled up and confused. Things don't make sense. And that's very upsetting. We don't like that. And other times, strong emotions take over the system. And we're too angry, or too depressed, or too agitated to even think straight. We don't like that much either. So it's not a flawless system, that's for sure. And if we believed that it was a flawless system, you probably wouldn't be here, you know? You'd be happily doing an ordinary sort of day, you know? Having fun or getting something done, you know? So it must be that you've noticed all this and are interested in whether this can help, whatever this is. But I think that really the amazing thing to me is that not so much that the mind gets tangled up and confused, but that the mind isn't always tangled up and confused. Why is it there's ever a break from that? Why do things ever settle down for even a minute? Or are we just fooling ourselves? You know, it's kind of like many of you commented who came from the south on the traffic, you know? And I was actually in Seattle on Thursday and drove back so I could relate. And, you know, we know that there's too many cars and there's barely enough capacity, but the thing just kind of barely works most of the time until there's an accident, right? And then the accident messes up everything. And that's upsetting, you know? Of course, on a good day, we remember our compassion and we spare a little thought for the people who are actually in the accident, probably a hell of a lot more upsetting for them than it taking an extra 45 minutes or an hour of our day to get somewhere. That for 99% of human history would have taken you a couple of days anyway. You know? But no, we moderns, we can get places at 70 miles an hour, so that's what we expect, you know. But anyway, I was just thinking the analogy to the mind might be, how is it that two cars ever pass each other going 70 miles an hour and don't crash? That's amazing, you know. That's amazing. So that the mind actually is okay most of the time. We're a little jittery, maybe, more of the time than we care to admit or notice. Perhaps because we don't have actually all that much confidence in the system, much confidence in the stability of mind from day to day, from moment to moment. I don't think we think about this all that much. You know, we're busy with our day, right? We have stuff to do. We don't think much about the process that's happening underneath all this, which we call the mind. But don't you think that even though we're not consciously noticing that this, just below the surface, there's a little kind of anxious energy, maybe all the time, about the very real possibility of losing it at any moment? Don't you think that's true? Which is maybe why we're so interested in staying as busy as possible. I don't know. I don't want to generalize too much about busyness. But that might be the case. If we just keep our focus out here, we won't notice the anxiety we might be feeling or not feeling or avoiding feeling in here about whether this whole thing is like even stable or sustainable, you know? We notice that there's anxiety, for sure. You talk to anybody now, they talk about anxiety. It's become socially okay to be a little anxious. Depression seems to be a little behind, you know. Depression's not so okay, but anxiety's okay. But I wonder if our understanding of anxiety is quite deep enough. When we tend to think about anxiety, we tend to think about something that we're anxious about, like the anxiety always seems to have like an object. And they're perfectly sensible objects, right? I'm anxious about the state of the world, I'm anxious about whether I'll survive my job or get through school, or I'm anxious about my kids. There's plenty that we can attach our anxiety to, and it's not wrong, you know? I'm not saying that it's not all a potential disaster. But I wonder if the real root of the anxiety is not those things, but this thing, the one in the middle. And so I think what's helpful, so interesting and helpful about this simplified way of life that we do here on retreat is there's much more space, you know, much more chance to explore deeper patterns of mind. And as Beth was saying, this isn't all going to be anxious and terrible, you know. Also surprisingly joyful. An explosion of interesting sound or ginger flavor. I had one of those pieces of ginger too. It's great. Wow. Because our mind is also often acting as a powerful overlay, you know, kind of on top of the rest of our experience. I was mentioning in I think pretty much all systems of Buddhist psychology, they recognize six senses and consciousnesses that connect to them, our usual five senses, and then the sense that's engaged in noticing thinking, which can really take over. So in the simplified situation, not only do we have a chance to sort of see that sixth sense in operation a little more clearly, but then we can also give a little more attention to the other five and see what we notice there. Which is what I was trying to say about breath awareness and body awareness and listening. What if we just deliberately work with our attention and give one of these senses a little more energy, a little more awareness? What will happen? We can find out. But I think sometimes mindfulness sounds a little bit like just taking a break or something. Should be fine. It's a good thing to take a break. I was thinking about reading you a long quotation from a Thich Nhat Hanh piece, but I decided not to. He's talking in that piece, I can email to you, about just relearning how to rest, you know? It's like, so in so many ways, so many of us have just forgotten how to really rest. I mean, we engage in recreation, right? Which isn't exactly the same thing, you know? Work hard, play hard, you know? So in these few days, a chance to take a fresh look at how it's all operating. Tools of meditation, tools of the senses, tools of different ways of thinking about these things. There's nothing wrong with thinking, it's what we've got. It's funny, I had this, somebody reported to me that they had the same thought driving up here that I did driving here. Which was, on the one hand, oh, this is so great. We get to be at Samish, we get to practice in this way for a whole weekend. On the other hand, darn it, only a weekend? What if we need a lot more time, you know? Just a few days? Then I was thinking, well, a few days is an amazing thing. A day is an amazing thing. A day is full of possibilities, full of moments where we could see something in a new way, experiencing our life in a fresh, with a fresh understanding. Another little snippet I picked up somewhere about Buddhist psychology is that they calculated somehow how long a moment is. Haven't you always wondered that? Like, what are they talking about being in the moment? Like, what does that mean? You know, what's a moment? How long does it last? Does it have any time? Well, according to these guys, there are 84 moments in a finger snap. So let's check this out. So there goes 84 minutes. Yeah. 84 moments, yeah, 84 moments, like that. So you could probably do a lot of finger snaps in one day, you know, if you kept at it. It's a lot of moments. But it's funny, isn't it, how the mind works? Arriving here for this wonderful opportunity and already regretting that it won't be the right thing. Amazing. So for these gazillion moments, let's study the mind. Let's learn a little more about how this works for each of us. And this kind of study is a little different from our usual kind of studies. You know, we have a kind of logical framework. How does this work? What leads to what? There's nothing wrong with that, but I think we need a broader frame for studying the mind. It's not so much learning how A always leads to B, and how C interferes with D due to process E. This was described by philosopher F, but scientist G disagrees. You know, that's the way we think, right? Does it go this way? And that's a kind of outside looking in way of studying, isn't it? Learning how this thing over here works, even if this thing is myself. Useful, but probably not enough. Maybe we can study the mind from the inside out at retreat, and then carry that forward into the rest of our days. Inhabiting the mind with curiosity and openness, willingness, kindness, with honesty, you know, oh gosh, look at that, wow. Or wow. Diving into the mind without turning away or distracting ourselves so much. Thus we have some of these structures which help to reduce distraction a little bit, at least. But we're pretty skilled at distraction, you know. We know how to do distraction. Even, you know, take away my cell phone, my reading, everything. I can find a way to get distracted, you know. We're pros, you know. So a willingness to set that down and just be in the middle of whatever's happening. Maybe we can think about all this a little more like exploring, a little less like being a scientist or trying to figure it out or something. Exploring our own life, exploring our own mind for a weekend. Exploring the territory. And there may be regions that are full of busy, busy, tangled thinking. It may feel like in our exploration that we're just kind of walking in place, buffeted by the winds of thought, memory, random snatches of imagery, waves of emotion, anxieties and fears, anticipations and hopes. But this is part of the opportunity to not sort of skate over the surface of that, to be in the middle of that, if that's what's here. To explore that, shouldering our backpacks, you know, willing to keep walking along, sometimes a joyful stroll, sometimes a trudge. But other times the territory is different from that. It's surprising. It's delightful, it's open, it's still. You never know, you know. You never know what'll be right around the next bend. So being interested in our thinking, but our mind is so much more than our thinking. The feeling behind the thoughts, the feeling in between the thoughts, what's coming in through the senses. And what are the patterns that emerge if we slow down enough to notice our patterns instead of just driving along and being driven by our patterns? There are three patterns in particular I wanted to mention that might be interesting to see if we can notice. And then I want to mention a few things from Buddhist psychology that seem to be always operating and sort of fueling these patterns. The first pattern you're super familiar with and gets talked about all the time in mindfulness land, and we've already been talking about it. But it's still worth spending a little more time, and I'm thinking now about time traveling. We know this pattern. It's super obvious, at least when it's in its cruder forms. We can watch the mind get lost, completely lost in the future, right? And completely tangled up in the past. Focusing so much on what's coming later or what came before, to the extent that we're barely even here, you know? And this pattern, like all three that I want to mention, is important and is useful. Essential, probably, for us to function. We need to be able to think about the past so we can learn something, you know? Learn from what happened before. And my standard line in mindfulness class is, you make a mistake, good idea to think it through, what happened, learn from it. Probably useful to think it through a couple of times, you know? There's so much there, right? Everything that happens is so rich. But there may be a point of diminishing returns here. The 10th time, the 100th time, the 1,000th time, the 300,000th time you go over that thing in your mind, you know, incessantly. Do you know this pattern? I wouldn't believe you if you said no. Eventually, it's what the psychologists call rumination. And it took me a while to notice that that word comes from cows. And it's useful for a cow to ruminate, you know, to run that difficult-to-digest grass through the stomach a few times, you know, multiple stomachs and all that. but not so useful for us to chew the cud of the past, you know, so constantly. And we need to be able to think about the future. I think the interesting thing about thinking about the future is this: the thoughts are not just sort of thoughts, you know? Like, we think we're so logical, you know, and it's just sort of connecting A to B to C, like I was saying. But actually, I think what's happening when we think about the future is we're imagining an entire future world, you know? We're thinking, well, if I make choice A, it'll result in this, and we start to, you know, visualize that in detail, manufacturing an entire world. And it was an interesting eye-opener to me to read in one of my various books about this stuff. If you put somebody in the brain scanner, you can tell them to imagine, you know, to visualize something, to think about a red apple or whatever. The visual cortex, the part of the brain kind of in the back center, I guess, that's active, that correlates to visual perception, gets busy. From the point of view of our neurology, of our brain, thinking about imagining something is kind of like the same as actually experiencing it. It's hard for us to tell the difference. Useful and problematic, you know, like the rest of the mind. So when we're imagining the future, we're creating a future world, you know, and we're living there, you know. That's where we are. Useful, we can look around and see what it's going to look like. Of course, it's pretty convincing, so we think it's real, you know. But we're no longer in the real world. And then the sort of multiplying factor that makes it a little more of a problem for us so often is we seem to be better at imagining trouble, future trouble worlds than future happy worlds, like way better. There may be some evolutionary basis to that. I spout these kind of very simplistic evolutionary stories sometimes, but I'm a little doubtful of them actually, you know. But it might be true enough that from our evolutionary past, we figured out and kind of hardwired in ourselves that it's better to be a little nervous and alert than dead and in a predator's stomach. So maybe that affects how this works. But it's pretty clear if you watch your experience or you read the studies and stuff that our thinking and our imagination tends to the negative. And so we're creating worlds that seem very real, and they're worlds full of disaster, and that has its impact, right? This affects us, makes us anxious. And the rumination about the past makes us depressed, you know? So part of the beauty of mindfulness might be that something just as so dead simple sounding as being more often inhabiting and connected to the present experience, whatever that turns out to be, will reduce all that quite a bit. Be happier, less anxious, less depressed. That's great. But also in a way, it's just kind of taking a break. And I wonder if some more fundamental change is possible too, more transformational change. And that brings us to the other two habits of mind I wanted to bring up. First one was time traveling. The next one is called flattening. And this is when the mind takes a very complex and rich situation, which is like, i.e. anything that's happening. I mean, it's so complicated, right? I mean, here in this room, think about it for a minute. We have 35 people, every one of us with a different history and past and, you know, personality and way of thinking about things. And, you know, here I am talking, here you are listening. Here I am assuming that you're hearing the words that I'm saying and thinking about it in the same way I am, which I know is not really true, but I still think that. You know, this is a complicated thing that we're doing every moment, you know? And yet the mind can just flatten it out to lecture. You know? That was an interesting lecture, thanks, you know? You know? Oh? I remember one time I went to my first 7-day retreat. It was in the Zen tradition, you know, we do a pretty full day, but even a longer day, lots and lots of meditation, and I was trying really, really hard, you know, to do it right, which took its toll, you know, took its toll. It's a long story. But anyway, the part of it I was thinking of, so I got through this week and, whew, you know. I remember saying to somebody, I don't know where this thought came from, I remember saying to somebody at the end, like, that was the best thing I've ever done and the hardest thing I've ever done, and why do those go together, you know? This doesn't make any sense. There was a great feeling when I don't know if I was just surviving it or if I really had some transformational thing that happened. But anyway, a sort of high-ranking person, I didn't have a car, and a high-ranking person from the Zen Center was driving me from that place to the other property they had. And she asked me about the lectures. Because it's like this, there's a lecture every day. They were longer than this, like hour and a half, you know. Long, intricate lectures about Buddhism. Very cool and interesting and confusing, and I slept through some of it, you know, but I liked them. She asked me about the lectures, said, what did the abbot talk about? So, like, well, you know how embarrassment sticks so strongly? I couldn't remember a thing, you know. I said, I don't really know, sorry. I think I was there, but I don't really know. So I'd flatten that down to nothing, you know. But we do, everything we see, we flatten it out because it's a shorthand that we need, you know, it's useful. It's another useful quality of mind that we overuse. And when I introduce this, I often read a poem, so maybe I'll read you my poem. You may have heard this or read it yourself many times, but all good things bear repeating. This is Mary Oliver's The Summer Day. We can wish for summer days to come, too, while we hear this. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention. How to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down into the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So we've all seen grasshoppers, probably. We all probably know, maybe from the nature show, you know, if not from direct knowledge, that they have enormous complicated eyes and jaws that go this way, and, you know, all the things that she noticed. But it's so easy for us to say, oh, well, look at that, oh, grasshopper. What were you saying? You know? And miss it, you know, and miss the richness that is grasshopper. Flatten it down to a word, 10 letters, you know, a concept. And then we're not seeing a grasshopper at all. We're seeing a concept in our mind. And we need this handy shorthand, right? How would we get through the day if we were truly not flattening anything and allowing everything to enter fully into our mind and heart in its complexity and unimaginable richness and mystery, you know? There's probably like some kind of problematic psychological condition that's like that, just being too open to everything. You wouldn't be able to function. But do we take it too far, like way, way, way too far, and start missing the actual world that's around us and within us, missing the beauty and the majesty and the incredibleness of every moment? And so mindfulness maybe is another way of sort of like rediscovering, you know, rediscovering a lost country in our explorations. The lost country that's around us all the time. Because we're just seeing like a screen, you know, a simple version on a screen. You know, Plato's allegory of the cave, has that become our life? We're just seeing these reflections on the wall of the cave, you know? These shadows on the wall of the cave, I mean. And taking them for real things, real objects, real life, real world. And so it's a little bit what Beth was talking about when she noticed the ginger, you know? Let it wake her up for a second. Not just, oh, they put ginger in that. I should buy ginger more often. I like ginger, you know. Good stuff. Now, what was I worrying about, you know? Actually, to experience it fully, or as fully as we can. And, of course, this is an endless, there's endless depth here. She could have spent a lot longer with that grasshopper. So I don't know what we'd call the opposite of flattening. Inflating again, you know, reopening, inhabiting. This image of like pumping with a little pump, like pumping things back up that you smushed down and deflated in your life. Will everything that we rediscover be delightful? No. Some will be. Some may be horrifying. Really difficult, really challenging. So I want to say a word there about skillfulness and intentionality. This is a long process, a slow process, a careful process. We do seem to need to have a willingness to try things new and to take some mild risks with our mind. But be careful, be careful. Especially if there's a history of trauma in your life. Some things can be very triggering, very difficult. We want to kind of keep it within a window of what we can handle, you know, maybe a little challenging, but doable, handleable. So if you go into overwhelm, pull back again, you know. Don't engage so much. Relax. Lie down, open your eyes. Let yourself be distracted, you know. Go ahead and worry about work, you know. That'll calm you down. Or at least get you back in your normal consensus reality where you know how to navigate, you know. Get you appropriately miserable or something, I don't know. But not inappropriately overwhelmed, you know what I mean. Like for instance, we do talk a lot about breath awareness, which for most people is soothing. For most people, an open, steady breath, a fuller breath, ties into the sympathetic nervous system, calms us down, connects us in with our vagal nerve system and heart rate, blah, blah, blah. You know about some of this stuff, I'm sure, and I know just enough to go blah, blah, blah about it. That's true of most of us. But for some people, this is not the case. Nothing is always so. Nothing always works, whatever works means. So focusing in on the breath or opening your senses or being that vulnerable is too hard, is too upsetting, is too vulnerable. Don't do that, you know. In the case of breath awareness, maybe better to feel the whole body, maybe better to just kind of be in tune with the space around you, maybe better just to ignore the instructions altogether and just kind of hang out, you know. And if something really strong comes up, come grab me in the first aid cabin or Beth in B1 and we'll talk about it. And I appreciate a few people already have, so you took my invitation for reals, which I appreciate. That kind of stuff's funny, right? He said I could interrupt him, but I don't think he really meant it, you know. Or not, I'm not me, though, you know. Maybe other people, you know. So anyway, flattening. Opening up to the richness and amazingness of life, which can also be overwhelming, right? And wonderful and difficult. The third quality of mind that's also useful and also a problem has an awkward title. They call it reification. Reification. Maybe reify used to be more in use as a common word in English. I don't know. I meant to look up the etymology. I haven't done that. But to reify something is to make it real. So reification is turning things, making things real that aren't exactly real. So this is like the realm of thoughts and projections and prejudice. Believing in our stories. And they all work together, right? You can see how time traveling to the future, you kick in reification, you know, and flatten out other stuff, you know. It all kind of flows together. So retreat is a great opportunity to study all of these, and the way I've noticed reification happening is in the assumptions I make about people. Because we're not really talking, right? At least I hope you're not. It's a good opportunity to be quiet, if challenging at times. And yet somehow, just based on like somebody, the way they move their shoulders when they walk, or the way they look, or something, you can make up really interesting stories about people. You chew them over in your mind, you think about them, and you wonder how this person got to be that way. Our negativity bias seems to be present here. I've made up really lovely stories about people at retreats, you know, but a lot more nasty stories than lovely stories, actually, you know. Why is he that way, you know? Driving me insane, you know. Doesn't he know that he shouldn't, you know, whatever, you know. Can you believe that person who let the door slam? Oh my gosh, that person's obviously really out of touch. Why is he even here, you know? I bet, you know, and just goes on from there, you know. But of course we do reification and the believing of our thoughts in much more subtle ways than that. Makes us rigid, makes us narrow, prevents us from inhabiting the flexibility and openness that's really our birthright. Sometimes in mindfulness we talk about different ways of sort of being the opposite of reifying and projecting in that way, making everything we think and assume to be real. With terms like a beginner's mind, a lovely phrase, beginner's mind. Whether you've done this one time or a million times, to show up as a beginner, you know. Ready to be surprised. Not so sure. Talk about curiosity. Curiosity is a great antidote to reification. We find the mind leaping to a conclusion, a summary, a judgment, and maybe trailing in behind it somewhere, we can invite curiosity. I wonder if that's really true, you know? I wonder if it really is that way. I wonder if she really is that way that I'm assuming. Or just, I wonder. You get to say to yourself, I wonder. And you don't even need to finish the sentence. Just, I wonder. So in a way, all this talk just boils back down to the simplest instructions that we started with. And you first heard when you started exploring this territory of mindfulness training. Just pay attention. Slow down a little bit. Simplify things a little bit. And pay attention. See what you notice. Be willing. Be curious. You know, be skillful about it, as I was saying. But show up and see what you notice. Is the mind lost in time travel? Can you come back to the present? Are you sort of tuning things out and just walking along the hallways of your flattened out life, you know? Can you pause and open up the senses? See things a little more fully, hear things a little more fully, feel things a little more fully. Oh. And when you find yourself believing in your narrative, which is hard to notice because of how constantly we do it, But maybe in a moment there's a little gap in the thinking, you know? A little shift in perspective or perception. You say, oh, that's just a thought, you know? I'm back. What is this I that I think is back? I don't know. You know, beginner's mind. Something's back. Something's happening. And here's a new moment. 84 more. And the cool thing is that the world is patient. Our body is remarkably patient with us. We could have a lot of gratitude for that, I think, you know? We finally come back to the body. The body's like, okay, well, I'm ready here. I've been here all along, you know? I'm ready to help you understand the feeling of being present in every moment. I may have a little sort of backlog of information to give you about stress and pain, you know? Sorry, I am going to have to share all that with you, you know? But I'm patient, you know? If you can only take some of it now, I'll just save the rest for later. So we have the body, we have our world around us. We have the birds and the wind and the trees and the pieces of ginger and the granola. So we don't have to worry about getting this all figured out or doing it all right or being efficient about it. It'll happen in its own time. And I think one of the characteristics about knowing these patterns more fully that I, at least in my experience, is the shifts that happen are almost always a surprise, you know? You can't make this stuff happen. Sometimes it's sort of a gradual dawning, other times it's a sudden, like, oh, gosh, I never really thought of that or saw that before. And you practice a while, you'll gain a little collection of memories like that, which encourage you, but of course then they're just memories in the past. I was remembering one time in this very campground right on the lawn out there, I somehow really tuned in to one of those little teeny English daisies. Have you noticed them in the lawn? Take a look, you know, they're kind of amazing. And I really tuned into one, and then it sounds stupid to talk about later, like, oh my gosh, the universe opened up and all this. But that was kind of what it was, you know. But it wasn't a special thing because I'm an advanced meditator. It was just like, finally, you notice me. I've been here in the lawn all along, you know. Silly humans, you know. Walking along, thinking your lofty thoughts, you know. And then you actually notice a little English daisy, and you go, wow. Oh my gosh. Unbelievable. Because it is. It is literally unbelievable. There's more there in every moment, every flower, every breath, every breeze than we can believe or understand, or conceptualize. This whole world is unbelievable. So maybe we'll end with a poem. And then just keep exploring this life for the rest of the weekend and the rest of our lives. Which, as she said in there, we don't know how long that is. Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? What do you want to do with this one wild and precious life? So maybe we'll, let's have a Mary Oliver festival. We'll do another Mary Oliver. She recently made a new collection, like her kind of selections from all of her works over 55 years of writing or something. Big, thick book, so we could have a Mary Oliver festival for a long time. But here's another one by her called I Worried. I worried a lot. Will the garden grow? Will the rivers flow in the right direction? Will the earth turn as it was taught? And if not, how shall I correct it? Was I right? Was I wrong? Will I be forgiven? Can I do better? Will I ever be able to sing? Even the sparrows can do it. And I am, well, hopeless. Is my eyesight fading or am I just imagining it? Am I going to get rheumatism, lockjaw, or dementia first? Finally, I saw that worrying had come to nothing and gave it up and took my old body and went out into the morning and sang. Finally, I saw that worrying had come to nothing and I gave it up, took my old body and went out in the morning and sang. So shall we follow her instructions? Let's have walking meditation next. The singing can be the quiet variety, but nonetheless, please sing. Thank you very much. Thank you.